Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and I'm here with my good friend, Chris Russin. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Happy to be here.
I'm excited to get an update from you. You were one of the first guests on the show, and it's been a few years. A lot of stuff has happened, but we're going to get like generally an update. We're going to talk about things that you have been up to and a couple topics that have been on my mind more often, just with conversations with people who like just stopped working or they're thinking of stopping working, and they've heard other people talk about really like an identity crisis kind of situation where someone has this job, they have a career, and now they're turning that off. Mm-hmm. And there's some status, there's some other things like far outside money and the portfolio and the 4% rule. And it's more, it's in our heads. It's the mindset stuff. So we'll see how much stuff we get to. We can go on and on forever. But Chris, for the folks that didn't hear the first episode, we'll link up. But who are you? What do you do? What's your like overall story?
Yeah, this should be a good episode because I've got a lot of experience with all of that. Yeah, so my name's Chris. I left traditional work when I became FI about 8 years ago now. I don't know if I'm doing the math right. Let me think about that. I don't want to misspeak. 7 years ago or so. At the time, you know, I left and my mission was to stop working for other people for money, start working for myself for happiness. And so that included a whole bunch of adventures and then also a bunch of projects. And then, yeah, most recently, I guess my new title is professional musician, and we might touch on that as well.
What was your corporate job?
So I've had a lot of different jobs. I worked corporate as an engineer and a project manager. I've started small startups and done a whole bunch of different things, but mostly in tech and a lot of it in healthcare and medical device.
Okay. And you had sort of that corporate job, I think if I'm doing the math right, say 15 to 17 years?
Yeah, that's about right.
Okay. And you talked about like your bucket list items in the previous episode. And I think the title was something like Indiana Jones of the FI community, because you were doing pretty cool adventures and just amazing stuff. Things where it's like what we read articles about and about other people, but you have all these great stories. So I'm not going to ask you to retell them now, but like you had this list of stuff, and how is that working? Are you still running through a list of stuff? Like I've never created like a bucket list, and you know, part of it is maybe my personality, but also like now that I'm semi-retired-ish, like we're just kind of running through some stuff and I don't view it as a bucket list, but yeah, what's the bucket list doing for you these days?
Yeah, there's a lot there. So let me start with the bucket list concept, because you just hit on it. And it, of course, it can be a trap, right? Like you don't want to have this list that you have to do to feel complete, because you'll never finish it. And that's the way it should be. You know, like I look at my list when I first made it as an aspirational sort of idea thing, but I'm not looking to check a bunch of boxes. I'm also not waiting until I'm old and about ready to kick the bucket to start pursuing these things, trying to work them into your life incrementally. And so, yeah, second of all now, the Indiana Jones of FI moniker. I think Carl came up with that, and I love it because I'm a huge Indiana Jones fan. Mm-hmm. I did do a dinosaur dig. I did dive for sunken treasure. And then I think I was working on a screenplay when we talked the first time.
Oh, yeah.
And those were some of the adventures. But my thoughts on bucket lists have changed a little over time. You know, back in that episode, I was talking about, I went online and I looked at like bucketlist.com or something, and it kind of compiles everyone's top, you know, their bucket lists and what are the top 10 things that show up on all these bucket lists. And it turned out that most of those could be done for $1,000 or less. And so I was making the case that it's less about money to make these things happen and more about putting the time and the intention behind it to do it. And I had found that to be true for myself post-FI when I did have the means. It was more about prioritizing them and fitting them in, because I am married and have two kids, so I have other responsibilities as well. And I also don't want to live some 100% hedonistic life that gets old after a while, just going from, you know, beach to beach or something. But what's changed over time for me, and one of the things I didn't realize then, is that there's another barrier. You know, I'll just use a couple of examples from that top 10 things people have on their bucket lists. I think one of them is write a novel, and another one is run a marathon. For me, something I've always wanted to do was put out a music album, an album of kind of duets, a really professional album with a professional studio. And what all three of these things have in common are there's an element of a fear there, a fear of failure. You know, it's nice to have the plan to do it, but when it comes to the reality of having to make it happen and the possibility of failing, or having to put it out there publicly that you're committing to this with people, I am going to run a marathon, I am going to write that novel, I am going to put out this music album. What if it sucks? What if I fail? What if I try to run that marathon and I only make it halfway through? And then everybody asks me about it on Monday and I have to tell them all that I suck. You know? That fear is often unfounded, or the reality of that happening is less detrimental than it seems. But, you know, it's certainly factored in for me, and not to dwell on it too long, but, you know, I did go through cancer a few years ago. And while going through that, I had done a lot of great things, you know, and I had had time to spend family. So that was great. But I realized I never did do this music thing. And I realized what was holding me back was this fear and my reputation. And when I looked at the possibility of not making it through chemo successfully in the early days, you know, that idea of reputation is laughable. Mm-hmm. Who cares whether people remember I sucked at an album if I'm dead? You know, it doesn't matter. Like, it all goes away. And so I kind of made a pact with myself, get over yourself. You don't matter that much. And that's a good thing. You can relax, and I am going to do this album. And I think that's been a learning for me with regards to the bucket list thing, is that sometimes the barrier is a personal one. It's more complex than just the money or the time, the prioritization.
Yeah, so many jumping off points. The most obvious, almost exact parallel with Mad Scientist in his album, you know, Brandon, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, he's talked about it on his show, and I think he's talked about it on other podcasts, so people can go kind of search that out. But I mean, it sounds like almost the same thing. Like, once work wasn't there, you run out of excuses. You obviously went through cancer and chemo, and like, going through that, you know, what was that, like an 18-month period of, I can't remember how long.
The chemo was relatively short, but extremely debilitating because it was so aggressive. I think I went through 3 cycles. And I say I think because it's all a blur. There, you know, I watched a TV series while I was going through chemo. And then some months later, after chemo, I started watching this series from episode 1, and I thought, this seems vaguely familiar. And then I realized I had seen the entire thing after like forwarding through episodes. But the recovery is longer after that. You know, one of the things people don't know if they haven't gone through a serious disease or cancer is that there's this idea of, oh, I'm cured now, but it's never really a hard stop. It's more of a slow realization, or get your confidence back, you know, because with cancer, you've got 5 years where you're in remission and you're still getting scans. You could say, I'm not cured yet, but then you're going to give another 5 years to the disease. And so you have to make that choice to make plans and live life regardless of the risk. And that is very acute in my situation, but it applies to everybody, right? Like, You need to just live and make plans rather than being fearful, you know?
I'll ask one more question around this, and then hopefully we'll talk about lighter topics.
yeah. Lighter.
So everyone's different. And I know, like, I'm probably, I'm probably judging myself incorrectly, but like I do and have thought about death often since probably I was in high school or something like that. Yeah. Not like in a like a dark suicidal way, but more just like the nihilistic view of like we're all gonna die. Like some things matter, but like most stuff doesn't matter too much. So I'm curious, like, are you the kind of person that does or that did think about death and like I have my family and like we could die at any moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So did you think about that before, like mentally, like no one could prepare you for the diagnosis of cancer. I get that. But like, did you think about death before in that kind of way?
Yeah, I did think about it. I think we purposefully block that out. We all know, like we're the only animal on earth that knows it's going to die. I mean, maybe not, but all of history suggests that every other human has died, so we're probably going to die too. I thought about it. I read a book when I was younger called The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker, and his contention is that the fear of death drives so much of society and our own individual drives as well. I think there is something to that. But yeah, I will say, coming out of this experience, I don't view death as a big, heavy thing. You know, like you said it, and I think I said a little bit of it too, like we're all going to die and like nothing really matters that much. That sounds depressing. It is not. I believe it's the opposite of that. There's a lightness to it. You have time and health today to do something. Even if you're terminally ill, you still have some health and some time. And what are you going to do with that time? And so that can be a really freeing thing.
And it does make you look at some stuff that like actually doesn't matter too much. And you're like, oh, you know what? I don't give a fuck about comments on YouTube or it's like, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
Right?
Or like even like my dream house. Ever since I was a kid, I've designed a dream house, mm-hmm. you know, with like all these features. I want a secret passageway and I want all this stuff. And I still think that's cool. But when I was going through treatments, I was like, how silly is that? Who cares if I'm in that house or an apartment? Like, when you don't have health, you know, it's like the, to the FI community, when you don't, you know, money's like oxygen. When you don't have it, it's all you can think about. Health could be substituted for money in a big way there as well.
All right. Well, super fun episode.
Lighter topics.
This episode about death. No. that little segment brought to you by Ghost Bed. So we'll do our little live.
Nice segue. Live. Death and Ghost. I like it.
Ghost. So we were just chatting earlier. Like I'm taking a trip with my dad out to Yellowstone and you saw a book upstairs and it was like some Yellowstone something. I actually bought, I think like 3 Yellowstone books via eBay. And one of them is like a ghost story book, which is kind of interesting. And now, thing is, when I travel and I'm outside of my normal bed, I have a Ghost Bed Luxe, so it's kind of soft. There's a nice cooling layer. On the vacation, I know I'm not going to sleep that well. But one thing I do like to do is, before I travel somewhere, I'll get books about the place. Sometimes they're travel essays. In this case, I've seen this Yellowstone ghost or haunted Yellowstone in the gift shops before. And I was like, you know what? I don't believe in ghosts, just to be clear, folks. I don't believe in ghosts, but I love the history and I love the stories about it. And as a kid, I would always watch those like unsolved mystery kind of ghost story things. It's just cool. So I'm reading those books, but I'm curious, do you believe in ghosts?
I don't believe in ghosts, but I'm still afraid of them.
Yeah.
And
we respect them, you know, just in case.
What I mean by that is, yeah, ever since I was a kid, I've always been, you know, like I look behind me when I walk up the stairs out of the basement, even though I know it's totally irrational. And so, yeah, I got to think if there were ghosts that we would have some more evidence by now, especially with cameras on every device in the world and everything being recorded. But you know, I'm still afraid of them.
Yeah. Like I said, it's always interesting. And when I go to an old town, like I love Leadville. Have you spent time in Leadville?
Yeah. Love it there.
It's so cool. We should do a trip up there, like just go do some hiking or whatever. But it's one of these old mining towns, and there's always great ghost stories about old mining towns or in old mining towns, like various restaurants, or there's a bar, or there's the opera house, the Tabor Opera House in Leadville, and like stuff happened there, and you could still feel the presence of the whatever, you know?
Yeah.
It's so cool.
The old mining stories and the ghosts that wander the hills around the mines and everything.
Yeah. So anyway, this episode is brought to you by GhostBed, and they have a bunch of different options in mattresses, and they have all the things that you need to sleep, and they have over 60,000 five-star reviews. They also have like adjustable base kind of beds and other kind of things like that. Pillows, we have one of their fancy gel pillows. It helps keep your head a little cool, and you can save 10% if you go to ghostbed.com/milehighfi. And I think that's totally site-wide. And you could also use the code milehighfi. So thank you to GhostBed. Now that we've used that ad read to transition to a new topic, I'm curious about what you've been up to. So you mentioned music and you've done a lot of traveling and it's been a while. So I'll leave it open for you. What have you been up to?
So let's see. I'll talk about the music because that's been huge. I've been working on this album and it was a long time to put together. You know, there was a pandemic. There was some very depressing topics we just talked about. And then coming out of that, there was recruiting a singing partner. There was lining up a studio. And then when I finally found the producer that I wanted to work with, he was booked 8 months out. So I had to wait another 8 months. I went through that time and then got to do this in a studio, record this album. And it was so much fun working with just amazing musicians. And I learned so much. And so, yeah, I've been doing that music and started to put it out. And also trying to keep some balance with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing I'm a little annoyed about with you, you got that great jawline, number one.
Why, thank
handsome,
you.
Handsome gentleman. You were an engineer, right? So you're smart, you got math and science, you got the jawline. You're a musician. You're a great athlete. You're the full fucking package, man. So a renaissance man.
I don't take compliments well. That's something negative about me.
No, but it's cool. Like such a diverse set of interest, and you're like pretty high level in many of those. Now, everybody has flaws. I know you're not perfect, man, but this is pretty cool.
We could talk about those.
Yeah. What's your worst quality? No. So I will ask about like your musical history. So like you played guitar like at a fairly young age and that's your main instrument. Can you just talk about like how your musicianship has shifted over the years? Like you've written for years, lyrics, poems, such that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I grew up in a pretty rural environment and the school I went to in elementary school was like a farming community. So music wasn't really valued, but I always loved music. I found like old tapes in the basement of my parents' house and would listen to, you know, like Willie Nelson, or I think it was like Pete Seeger and Arlo Guthrie, some of the stuff my mom used to listen to. And then at some point I found an old guitar in the basement and it was a 6-string, but it only had 5 of the strings. And so I would like figure out, you know, there was no internet to Google chords or anything. Yeah. And so I just started making up my own, but they all had 5 notes because there was not a 6th string. So like those early songs just had like 5 strings. But yeah, music's always been something for me where when I couldn't talk about it, I would write a song about it. Or if, you know, if I was going through something exciting or tough, often the best way to communicate it was a song. And so those songs really sucked when I was young, but I loved it. And I guess there's a lesson there about like getting good at anything is the love will make you good. You can suck as long as you have fun doing it. And if you have fun doing it over time, you'll get really good. And so if I started that when I was 14 and I'm now, you know, in my mid 40s, that's a long time to get good, even if you're a total moron.
Yeah, it's so interesting. So I recently listened to the Duff McKagan audiobook, and he's the bassist from Guns N' Roses, Velvet Revolver. Yeah. He has his own solo stuff.
I think he has a beer on The Simpsons too.
That was literally named after Duff.
Really?
It was, yeah.
That's funny.
It's crazy. They apparently sent him like, hey, we're thinking of, naming the beer Duff. And blah, blah, blah. He's like, yeah, that's cool. Use my name. And then it ended up being like a whole thing.
Nice.
The reason why I bring that up is I saw, and he mentions it in his book. And if you read many biographies, you'll find the same thing, whether it's musicians or comedians or writers or whatever. They got obsessed with music. In Duff's case, like he played guitar, he played drums. Bands often need a bass player, so he played bass and a drum set. Well, you know, when you move and you're living in a small place, it takes up a lot of space, so it's like he played bass, but he's a great guitarist too. So anyway, the point is he got obsessed. So he was like playing music and he was in bands from when he was like 12 or 13 years old. So again, he was probably very talented, but like you're putting these reps in, your mind is so like, it's malleable, it's able to learn faster, it really sticks with you. And I use that as a springboard recently to like ask people, I'm like, I wish I would have like played guitar then, because I want to play better now. I know I can get better, but like it's different learning now when we're in our mid 40s versus like when you're 12. So I ask people like, hey, what did you spend time and get obsessed with? I'm like, I think I wasted my time kind of like learning math and science. I'm a good student, blah, blah, blah. But now I'm like, I don't really care about that. I just want to play some cool riffs, you know, but it's cool. So you did music from such a young age, and I think it's awesome. You stuck with it over time.
Yeah. You know, I remember when I was young playing guitar out on the dock, for example. Like I'd go down there, I'd bring the guitar, do everything I could to not drop it in the water, because that's not good for a guitar. But it was super low pressure, you know? I would just sit down there, I would think, I would play a few things, lyrics would come to me, and it was very low pressure. And I think that's a great way to pick something up. You mentioned it would have been nice to do that when you were young. And certainly, yeah, all that research shows that your neuroplasticity is great when you're young and you pick everything up. But I think we sell ourselves short sometimes, like being older. You know, I started playing hockey when I was in my 40s. You know, I joined a team and that was terrifying, but wow, I learned, you know, the neuroplasticity was still there. There's still, you can teach an old dog some new tricks. I might have gone off topic there. No,
I mean, and you're 100% right, because like I played guitar a little bit for 20 years, but I didn't push myself. And that's the thing, like maybe it's easier to push ourselves harder and be frustrated when we're younger, because we have like infinite kind of time. But I actually recorded it and sent it to you. So I learned Never Going Back Again. And use the metronome. And the thing is, it's uncomfortable when you're on the edge of what you could do. But if you use a metronome or other similar techniques, right, you could be on the edge for a little while and like slowly get better. And I was shocked. It took a few months, but like I could play it at speed, which is like a lightning fast. I mean, it wasn't perfect. But I was like, this is a pretty decent take for some jackass like that just tried to keep playing.
I think you're a rock star. For the record, Doug sounds great.
Thank you.
And I think you hit on something there. Yeah, you're right. I guess I bet that as a kid, you're so used to being sucky at everything that what's one more thing to be sucky at? And then as an adult, you feel like you're good in all these comfort zone things and you want to stay in those zones. But yeah, if you can embrace the suckage, it has rewards.
Right. And the more things that you do that you suck at, which I mean, it's almost all the things that I do, it's just like you feel fairly comfortable. Like, you know, sure, I'll try that other thing. Like I've been bad at stuff. But yeah, Yeah, you're totally right. Interesting. All right. So music, been doing it a while. You mentioned, and it almost sounded like this was sort of like your first album, like professionally. You've put out other music before though, right?
Yeah. So I've put out, let's see, I guess 3 other studio albums. And when I say studio, it's like, I mean, that's a loose term. I mean, some of them were like a basement with a computer.
Like here, a basement with a computer, a couple microphones.
You've really spiffed up the digs from the last time I was here. This is a professional operation.
Thank you.
But yeah, I've put out other music, but I've never done a good job of marketing it or, you know, putting anything behind it. And there's a reason for that that I'll mention really briefly is like you do an effort. And when you're done with that effort, you're totally drained. And that's when you then have to sell that effort and somehow find the energy. And I've never done that well in the past. I also wanted to do an album that was really, you know, I got a Grammy nominated producer, a Grammy winning studio to do this project with me. I got some of the best musicians along the Colorado Front Range. Now, I will say, without humility, I don't suck. You know, if I did suck, I couldn't do that, right? And so there is a threshold. You have to, right? Like young Chris sitting on the end of the dock to Chris today learned something. He picked all that up. And so based on the merit of the songs, I was able to recruit those people. I also wanted to do this effort, and this gets back to the heart of your question, because I did feel like, wow, these songs, these are good songs, and they say something about life and love that I think is important and other people will resonate with and feel less alone. And so, you know, the point I'm at in life, and I'm hoping this resonates with listeners, is like, you know, here I am mid-40s, post-cancer, putting out a music album. What am I doing? Well, I feel like the work is important. It's not about me being famous or getting, you know, people clapping for me or some ego thing. It's more about creating, the joy of creating and putting something out there and then hoping that it impacts or helps people.
There's so much to go off of here, but before I forget, like you own all the music, right? You funded this whole thing. So like,
yeah.
can we play one of the songs? Like, at the outro?
That would be awesome.
All right. So we'll put that at the end. There's a couple, like you and I and another friend, actually, JT, we could mention it. We recorded up there.
Yeah, we did. We were on this.
Yeah. We hung out and we brought our guitars up there, goofed around a little bit, but you played for us some, which it was super cool because like it was a big open room with a fireplace and we had a couple whiskeys or something and you played some songs. It was cool.
That might have been the world premiere.
The live
with
performance.
Two people.
So the other part of this, so like you've been retired for a handful of years and we'll talk about it a little bit more, but like you largely didn't work, but you did a couple things after some time where you did earn money. Even though it was a, you know, minor amount. But the point being, when people retire, especially in our community, we're usually successful at our job, we're usually highly productive, slightly busy, you know, and I think some of us either tie our identity to our job or our title or like the network and their status, and then you're used to being productive, and then you stop. I get frustrated when people are like, I don't know what I would do. Like I stay pretty busy. There's more stuff that like I want to do. I can't even really fit it in. But the other part is like people do want to be productive. So after you spend some time doing like those in air quotes bucket list items, or you're like, I do want to travel, and maybe you could travel for, you know, 6 months or 3 years or whatever your threshold is. But like once you settle down and you're decompressed, it's like you do want to do the creative stuff and you want to create something and you spend a lot of time on it, Chris. But like, I mean, you had to hire musicians, you had to get studio time, you had to spend money on like mastering and like more production and like, let's go through this again. So all that to say, like, how important was it for you to like do this, you know, creative effort and like really put the time in? You've worked on it for years, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it has been a long time in coming. I think we've been on hikes years ago and I was like, yeah, Doug, I'm working on this album. You know, there's a lot of people that have a lot of ideas and they never do them. And something I've always tried to foster or, you know, appreciate and commit to is delivering. So this project took many years, you know, start to finish writing all the songs. I mean, there is one song on the project that I started writing when I was 18 and the chorus was never right. And I sat on it and kept rewriting the chorus and rewriting. The majority of the songs, I think, were 5 years in the making. But there's something there about making a little bit of progress over time. You know, if you keep going, it will be finished at some point. I don't know if I'm just the type of person that finishes or I advocate finishing, but, you know, committing and then just making a little bit of progress every day, every week, you know, like whether that progress for me was like rewriting a song or writing another one. I wrote all the songs except for the last one, which I wanted to write when the whole album was done. And that process took a long time. I don't know if that answers your question about the importance. I think we talked about some of it, like with regards to, you know, health and life and kind of things left undone and things on that list, you know, and barriers that may have been the real barriers preventing those from happening.
You had your corporate job. You were an engineer, entrepreneur, worked in startups. How much of your identity was like tied up in that? Did you have a difficult time transitioning from, you know, badass entrepreneur, you're a successful person, medical devices, and then no job? And you did your Indiana Jones adventures and stuff.
That's a great question. I remember the prestige of having a corporate expense account, you know, and the weight of the corporation behind me, you know, like, you show up and if you're a large account at a hotel, you get treated well, you get upgraded, you know. I imagine that gets, well, I know that that gets harder the higher you go. As an executive, as a CEO, you carry the entire weight of the company behind you. And so if something goes wrong on your flight or at your restaurant, they bend over backwards to make it right because of who you are and all of the business that's behind you. And so, yeah, identity. And what do you do with that when you leave traditional work? I think a big part of FI is not just the numbers of getting there. It's claiming that independence part. You have to be independent or you'll never be FI, quite literally and definitionally. But you've got to commit to it. And so for me, when I left work, you know, I was the program director at large for a startup and, you know, I was commanding multi-million dollar budgets and meeting with VCs who were rich and powerful and hopefully changing the world and saving lives with a new medical device. All of that has prestige and identity wrapped up into it. When you leave work, there's this piece about, why are you leaving? Are you lazy? You know, are you a burnout? People will impose their narratives on you, not necessarily to be mean, but just out of simplicity or a lack of understanding. And so you've got to commit to that identity. You know, early on for me, it was the mantra I think I mentioned at the top of this podcast. I'm working for myself for happiness. I'm not lazing around. This is an active work and I'm putting just as much drive and intention behind it as I did closing that next round of funding. You know, and I did do a lot, right? As you mentioned. Then with this music project, there's a similar thing with identity. It's, you know, who's this 45-year-old trying to put out music, you know? people have asked my wife, like, what's he doing? Is he having a midlife crisis? A lot of people don't think it is valid or important. You know, there are people who are going to say this is kids stuff or art is not important. I'm saying it is. I'm committing to it. And that's necessary to feel successful. And so, yeah, I think you've got to claim your identity. And on the flip side of it, I would say if you are leaving traditional work, right, and you had a high power position or really any position with prestige, and there is any job, there's something about, oh, that person's going out there working, creating something of value and providing for their family. And that gives you an identity and prestige. And that goes away. And so you have to be very intentional about what are you going to and will you stand behind that in the face of a lot of people that'll scratch their heads or say it's pointless or it's dumb or whatever, you know?
So to go further on that, because it's super interesting, and I don't think very much of my identity was tied up in different like jobs that I had. The fact that I could say like they were jobs that I had, even self-employed, I didn't even identify like with some of the stuff that I did from like 2015 to 2020. I was like, it's fine, but I wasn't like, I'm a marketer and I do SEO. Like I very easily transitioned out of that. You mentioned like it's important to go to something else. And I want to challenge that a little bit because I think sometimes people are just for shorthand type A, that they're like, okay, now I'm treating this new thing as my job. And then they get just as busy and they start burning out on the next thing they go to. And I'm not saying like the way I'm doing it is the right way, because I'm like I said, I didn't identify with many of the jobs that I did. So I'm just like, whatever. But it makes it easy to just be like, all right, I'm going to do a new thing. And it's cool if I don't have to commit to it. So can you expand on that a little bit? Or do you get what I'm laying down here?
I think so. I think you're saying, well,
okay,
are you asking about, do you need to do something?
Yeah.
Is it enough to just be you or relax or?
Yeah. To relax. And I think like, the previous question was like, everyone should have some need to be like productive or contribute or be part of the community. And like, there's a lot of different ways to slice it. But I feel like sometimes people say, oh, you got to make sure you have something, you're retiring to something. Mm-hmm. And I want to challenge it a little bit because sometimes people need to chill the fuck out.
Right. And okay. So yeah, what does chill the fuck out mean? Right. It means like, you're committing to, let's say what your path is going to be is you want to be a good husband and you want to meditate and have peace and you want to read books and you want to learn something new every day. You know, it doesn't have to be some grand new identity that rivals your old CEO title in your old life, but you have to claim it and you have to say this is worthwhile. And I would say, I think this might get to the heart of part of your question. They're type A and they need to chill the fuck out. The thing that got you here may not be the thing that gets you to the next spot. Identities can be tough to leave behind. And we talked about Brandon, the mad scientist. He had a really successful post-fi sort of role as a pillar in that community. And doing the podcast and doing the blog, but he knew that if he was going to dedicate himself to the music, he would have to make a change. And it would have been so easy for him to keep winning at what he was doing and be, another great podcast episode and so on and so forth. He had to make that decision to say, this is important. I'm gonna put my time toward this crazy synth sort of music that's very niche-y, and I love it, by the way. It's very different than my music, but I love it. So yeah, the thing that got you there is not the thing that gets you to the future. If you're going to say, if you're going to hang your hat on, I need another victory, another bonus in my role, another $1 million or another merger, or on a smaller scale, like I need to be senior manager instead of manager or whatever, like, what game are you playing and what is the prize behind that game? It may be pointless. It may be that you need to just chill the fuck out, to use your term.
Interesting. Okay. So jumping back to the music a little bit, you mentioned editing lyrics and just revisiting and trying to get it right. Like, it wasn't ready yet. And I'm not much of a perfectionist. I think I used to be. I think a lot of engineers, like, there's something glorious about accuracy and, like, you know, being being done. But with lyrics, with music, with writing, most art, maybe it's never done. You just keep going back. How do you know when it's done?
I don't know the number exactly, but I remember hearing something like 10,000 songs a day come out. 10,000 a day. And then all the people that have lived before, their songs are still out. So there's a lot of music out there. Creation's becoming easier and easier. And especially with, you know, AI and all these advanced tools, your creativity can be augmented. And so personally, I feel a responsibility to the audience to put something out that is my best, that is really good, because there's just too much crap out there. And if you want it to punch through, it should be better. And so, you know, I do advocate, like, applying yourself to things you love. And it's something I've always done, you know, like, I have worn a lot of hats and done a lot of things, you know, like, I don't know, engineer, manager, startup CEO, entrepreneur, college professor, all kinds of stuff, right? Each time I've done one of those, I've tried to do it really well. And so, yeah, with regards to this, it's like when you write a book, you write it, but then the rewriting happens and the rewriting and then it really starts to take shape. And so with these songs, you know, I wrote them, I actually submitted one to, like, a master class at the song school, Planet Bluegrass's song school, which is really just, it's not bluegrass, but it's a school for people to write music. And I got accepted on the strength of that song. And then I went in and I studied with this guy, Pat Pattison. He's like a Berklee School of Music professor on songwriting. Mm. And wow, he showed me so many things. And I looked back at my songs and I said, oh man, there's so many things that could be better about all these. And so the rewriting, you know, and then you get in the studio and the producer knows things. They know this part is a lull in the song and we need to get rid of that. And you take that advice because he's a Grammy nominated producer. And so, yeah, it's kind of like, I think, upping the bar along the way. And then you know it's done when the message gets through and people remember. You know, like, if I hear one of my sons singing my chorus, I'm like, yes, that song might be close to done.
That's cool. Can you share how much it costs to produce the album? It's okay if you don't want to, but just curious.
Yeah, I don't mind. It's a lot. Because I used professional studio and professional talent, let me think about that. It's not that I don't want to, it's that I can't remember. I want to say it's going to approach about $1,000 a day for studio time. So, like, half of that would be the producer and engineer. Other half would be the studio. That can vary wildly depending on how big and, you know, big names and all that. And so when you put it all in, like, the time in the studio, compensating musicians that are helping you out, I'm going to spend, you know, over $10,000 on the album and probably closer to 15 or 20. And then that's not including any promotional effort,
right?
Which, if I'm putting all that into the project, I should put some into promotion too, because, you know, like, if a tree falls in the woods and no one hears it, why'd you do it? So yeah, it's a big effort. And if I wasn't Fi, if I wasn't Fat Fi at this point, I would do it differently. I would definitely do it. I would just do it differently.
Yeah. Interesting. And it, you know what? That's less than I expected, you would say, aside from the promotion, because, like, that's potentially, like, unlimited. You could put it, you know, put more into it. But if you at least equal, like, whatever you put into, you know, the 10K and then a little bit. Anyway, and it's interesting.
I'll throw this out there because I think it's fascinating. Is, like, I also worked with a lot of people online. So, like, I wrote a string quartet for one of the songs, and I hummed all the parts and I sent it to a group in the Ukraine who actually recorded the, you know, recorded that part. I sent a part to a guy in France and he played it on hammer dulcimer. There's another guy, he lives in like swamps in the middle of England, and he played dobro on one of the songs.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So you can collaborate really affordably with a lot of people online, you know, because they can do it in their home studio. You pay them, you know, $50, $100, and they'll nail it in less than an hour and send it back to you.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Man. Okay. We got to wrap up before too long. So we're going to do some quick hit kind of stuff. Number one, we alluded to you doing some work, and that was as a college professor. Can you talk just a little bit about that and like why it was a good choice for you to teach?
Sure. Yeah. So to clarify, I was a lowly adjunct faculty.
Yeah. Not a professor. That's it.
But yeah, why did I do it? It's because most of my career has been coming up with, you know, new products and inventing kind of. And there was a course around that, you know, students, we give them an open-ended problem and they got to prototype something and make it happen. So anyway, at the end of that course, there's a pitch event, kind of like Shark Tank, where everyone pitches and they try to win and they get a little money if they win. And they brought in judges from industry. And I got invited in as a judge from industry. And on the strength of that, I guess, judging a few times, they were like, have you ever thought about teaching? And I was like, actually, yes, I have, but I don't have my PhD. You know, based on the strength of 15 years of entrepreneurial experience, they said, we'd still love you to apply. And so I did that. And it was kind of like a life design experiment. Like, is this something I'm going to love? And could it grow into more things or not? And so, yeah, I've taught for a few years. I'm not currently doing it. I might go back at some point. And it's nice to have that door open. That's something I didn't know when I was younger, is that like all these people you meet and these roles and the relationships, it's not like the doors close. They're always still there. Hmm. So yeah, that's kind of how I got into it.
How was it like the first day? Were you nervous? Because it seems terrifying, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
Yeah, what was that like?
First of all, first day is hilarious because I was locked out of my own classroom. Like, I got a badge and it wasn't configured yet. And so I'm like, I got to show up early, run through my PowerPoint and my slides and... Yeah. And then I'm locked out. And I had to get like a student to let me in 5 minutes before it began. And then you're looking out and you're like, are they going to know that I'm just a big phony? You know? And then, but yeah, one step at a time, right? Like the passion for it pulled me through. Like that's the thing, right? Is like, as someone who did this in industry and saw it really work, I had a passion that like a college professor that just knew it academically didn't have. And that made me good early, but I sucked as a professor, pedagogy or whatever, you know, teaching ability.
Yeah.
And then you just fill that in. You watch other people. I would sit in the back row of the director of the department when they would give the same class and then watch them. And, you know, you just one step at a time and hopefully it all balances out, both the passion and the ability.
Another thing we chatted about was unplugging and just being away from our laptops and our phones and just Wi-Fi and that kind of thing. The Wi-Fi was out, or like the internet was out here in town for a few minutes this morning. And Elizabeth was like, where's the router? Like, I forget. And like, we had a little panic, like we don't need it to record down here. I was like, I'm cool. Like, I somewhat enjoy it when I don't have internet. And yeah. Anyway, so unplugging, tell me your recent experience.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I think it can be super hard these days, especially with, you know, how addictive all these platforms are and with news cycles and how they all suck you in and clickbait to unplug. You know, with me and this music project, I just launched a single, the third one on the project, last Friday. And it was a lot of work building up to it. And I noticed from the first two that I started to care, you know, like how many people are streaming it on Spotify? How many people looked at the video on YouTube? And I would look at those numbers and I was getting a little too wrapped up in it, you know, like, cause that's not why I did it. I didn't do it to get 10,000 views instead of 5,000. I did it to get it out there and see if it had merit. That was a success. Whether it's 5 or 10 doesn't matter. So, you know, I don't need to focus on that. Like, I'm over focusing on it. I'm getting wrapped up in it. And so, yeah, this last launch, I got invited on a really cool fishing trip to like a stream up in the middle of nowhere that no one gets to fish, and we were going to catch these monster trout. But I was like, no, I got to be around for this launch. I got to get 10,000 views instead of 5,000. And then I decided, like, you know, that's not what I preach. That's not what works. And I forced myself on launch day. I launched it. By noon that day, I was in a car. I was off the grid for the next 2 days, you know, entirely gone from the launch. It was a cool exercise. One, to unplug and not have any devices. And two, to say, while I like this and it's important to me, I don't want to get wrapped up in it for the wrong reasons. And maybe this comes back to some of what we've been talking about, right? With career and identity and all of that. Like, you got to keep a healthy balance.
Yeah. I got to do a unplug thing here before too long. It's been a while and I do catch myself like mindlessly. I don't scroll social media too much, but I watch a lot of YouTube. So I'll like look for YouTube videos and usually it's interesting and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, I know like that sort of dopamine cycle, not healthy. Yeah. You have the phantom vibration in your pocket, you know, and it's like, I don't even have my phone in my pocket, but I feel something in there. You ever get that?
I got that when I was fishing. I was like, oh, something's coming in. Wait a minute, I don't even have my phone.
It's wild. If you don't know what we're talking about, yeah, like if you go off grid or whatever, and you actually don't have a connection, or you don't have your phone, or you brick or turn your phone off and keep it in your pocket, you'll start feeling stuff and you're like, ooh, did it go off? And yeah. You're like, I better check that. Is that a text message? Like, what's going on? Weirdest thing.
And I should clarify, I had my phone. It was on airplane mode, but I had it because I needed to take pictures of the giant fish that I caught on the stream.
Can you send us some pictures of that? We'll edit them in.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. For the YouTube folk. All right, very good. So we covered a ton of stuff. We will play the song at the end. Maybe we'll get the video. I know you have a video for a couple of them. So on the YouTube side, people could actually watch that. Is there anything that you want to mention before we wrap it up? Anything that we didn't talk about that you're like, I kind of want to mention this quick thing?
I mean, I'll say something really quick about the joy of collaboration. You know, you were talking about Duff earlier and how he got to play in bands since he was little. I didn't get that opportunity, you know, and whether it's playing music with a big group or running a business or whatever, that can be a collaborative effort. That was super rewarding and unexpected for me on this project. And so, you know, I come in with a part and an idea, but then I bring in a bass player who's, you know, plays on many Grammy winning albums. That guy's got abilities I don't have, and being open to taking that feedback and getting a better product overall and having it all elevate because of those people is a really fun thing and something I encourage people to try because it's scary. It feels like if I give up control, it could suck. But really, giving up control can be a great thing if you make sure you have guardrails in place. Like in this case, it was like, I got brought in a really great collaborator, you know? And so, yeah, that's been really educational.
So in that instance, was he like, cause he's a pro, he's recorded with a bunch of people. So he stays in his lane, can read the room and that kind of thing. But was he like, hey man, this is like, I have an idea. Like, do you want to hear it? And then you're like, sure. Like, what do we got? Like, how did it play out? Like actually in the studio?
Yeah, it's kind of like, all right, you tried one like my demo. Why don't you just try a few if you have any ideas? And they have ideas. And often things you don't think about because they know stuff you don't know. And I think that that's collaboration in general, right? Like everybody knows something you don't know. And so at least giving that perspective a shot will yield something. You know, you don't have to accept it. And there were times where I said, all right, I'm going to dial this back because there's something fundamental in this song that needs that part. Yeah, it can be great.
So we'll link up so people could find all the stuff, your Fi blog, the music, different places you're streaming, but I'll also let you mention, like, where do you want people to go to follow along or if they want to learn more about you?
Sure. I mean, it's just my name. So Chris Russin is me, and that's where the music is. So it's just Chris, last name Russin. It's one S, even though it's Russin. And I'm at chrisrussin.com. I am on all the streamers under Chris Russin, and I'm on YouTube. I actually did make a music video for every song that's come out. The last one features my wife and I together, which was fun to make. And so, yeah, and then I'm also at lifeoutsidethemaze.com. So things Fi related, if you've got a burning question or want to connect with me in the Fi world, you can reach out right through the website. All the messages go directly to me.
Sweet. And occasionally you go out and on hikes around here locally, and you may run into Chris, the trails around the Front Range area or events at Mr. Money Mustache HQ. Occasionally you pop up there too.
Yeah, that's true. If I am not putting out music, I am probably on a trail somewhere. So awesome. You'll see me there.
Really fun. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Doug. This has been a great discussion.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Fi podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. So in this episode, we talk about music some, and I'm curious, like, who are you listening to currently? Who should I check out? That sort of thing.
I mean, you're setting me up to say, listen to my music, Doug. No, I've been listening to a lot of folk Americana because that's what I've been writing. Yeah, I've been listening to Gregory Alan Isaacoff, The Civil Wars, Watch House, a bunch of bands kind of in that space.
How do you find new music? Because Elizabeth and I were chatting before, and I'm now getting into grunge. So Alice in Chains, yeah, and Soundgarden more, a little like those two bands, like I didn't really catch like the first time around, maybe a touch of Soundgarden. Uh-huh. But now like, I'm like, Alice in Chains is like fucking awesome. I really like them.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, that was like my tape and CD collection in the 90s.
35 years ago. Yeah.
But yeah, I find new music. So, I mean, Spotify is really good with their algorithms. If you play stuff you like, it'll play other things, and it's kind of creepy how good it can be. It can also be limiting because they'll feed the same 30 artists. And so if you want to break outside of that algorithm, that can be hard. But, you know, it's a nice way to find new music.
Gotcha. And you know what? I don't do Spotify. Like, I used Spotify for a few years. I think I had a free deal, like maybe, I can't remember how I got it, but I used it for a couple years. And then when my deal went away, I was like, I'm out. I don't really care. I don't use it. But is that like what a lot of people use for music.
I think you're giving yourself an in. If Spotify hears this and wants to offer Doug a free membership, you could do that. I use Apple Music because I roll it in with the cloud storage and the TV, and there's other perks. And then all my family's on iPhones. And so,
got it.
And what I love about Apple Music as a total music nerd is super high quality streams. You know, you can get insanely high def tracks if you're into that on Apple Music.
Gotcha. I have YouTube Premium, so I typically use YouTube Music. So similar idea where I'm like, I'm in that ecosystem and that works for me. But curious, so you listen to high def stuff. What kind of headphones are you using or what kind of speakers? Because like that would be the limiting factor if you have like really high quality data coming in, right?
Yeah, I kind of have some ludicrous sound equipment because I have a basement studio. But generally, I'm listening on my AirPod Pros just because they have insanely good noise cancellation. And then I'm always like biking down a mountain or running, you know, on a trail or something. And so having those super portable ones with noise cancellation is great.
Yeah. If mine died, I would buy new ones like the same day. Like I really like, I mean, I still have my regular AirPod ones that I bought like 8 years ago or whenever. I think one of them has a crack, but I still use them down here. Like they're still fine.
That's actually a cool thing about the Pros too, is you can search them and ping them. You can do a Find My on them.
Yeah.
Which you can't do with those like old Gen 1 AirPods.
That's right. Okay. So you have pretty crazy, like in your home studio. So you have like super nice headphones and other stuff. So like you really can hear like the spatial, like if they have multiple mics in the room kind of thing, you're like, oh wow. Like I hear the drum set over there and I hear the bass over here.
You know, I was tested in like fifth grade for music listening and I got the highest score in the whole school. And so I hear too much, you know, and I say too much, like I'll be out to a restaurant and in the background, there's like a persistent noise and I hear it and nobody else does, you know, I hear everything. And so the nice thing is when I hear great music, I hear all the parts and I hear where, you know, the spatial stuff you're talking about.
That's crazy. So you were the best in this school, but you were homeschooled though, right? No, I'm just teasing you, man.
Oh, I get it. Slow on the uptake over here.
Yeah. Great with music, but didn't. Okay. Interesting. I wonder, like Elizabeth, she's told me that like she gets distracted if music is on. Like I'll put music on. It will distract her. She's like, I can't like turn it off because I listen too hard. So I wonder if she's the same. And she grew up, like her mom plays the piano. And I think, anyway, music was on often. So I wonder if Elizabeth has that. Was music in your house?
Not hugely. But I mean, I remember in college when I was taking hard math classes, I would play like Weezer in my headphones really loud and do my math homework. And somehow that worked for me, like that persistent, those guitars with like crazy overdrive on them.
Yeah.
I know there's been research studies about something called the Mozart effect, where if you listen to Mozart while you're studying, it can actually improve your focus. I don't know. They're old studies, so I don't know if they still hold up, but certainly some kinds of classical music do it for people.
Would you listen to the same songs or the same album, like on loop or whatever?
Yeah. Okay. Like I would listen to the Blue Album that I know super well.
Gotcha.
Just over and over.
I've done that too. Yeah. Actually, I still do that. I'll put on like the same four songs or same song and just put it on loop and then work. Super rare for me to work though.
Shattered hearts and faded colors. I just can't look back no more. Heartache becomes living.